So thank you all for coming out again. This is session 199 titled, sorry, that's wrong. I've got the paper in front of me. This is session 171 titled Four Views of Joseph Smith, Historians Debate the Prophets Puzzle. Before we begin, I think you all know the rules. Turn your phones off to silent. Don't make me come after you. I will throw my shoe at you. Just kidding, I'm not. We are going to have a Q&A session, and since we're talking about such a broad range of things, we ask you to keep it mission-driven, mission-focused. Sunstone's mission is to allow thoughtful dialogue that does not attack the character and the faith of others. This session is being recorded, and your questions will be recorded as well. And to support Sunstone, make sure that you're subscribing to the magazine, make sure you're going and buying all these amazing books that many of you probably written yourselves. So go support Benchmark Books and check out that. I'm going to read the abstract from this, which can be found in your program, and then I'm going to explain and introduce the panelists. The mystery of Mormonism cannot be solved until we solve the mystery of Joseph Smith. Jan Shipps wrote, four decades later, the prophet continues to puzzle. Was he a true prophet, a sincere visionary, a pious fraud, or a con man? In a friendly debate, four historians will each advocate a different hypothesis. Opening statements and rebuttals will be followed by a Q&A. So what we're going to do is we're going to let them all talk, and then we'll let you guys do a panel discussion. As I introduce you, I'm going to tell you who's representing what position. And what I want you to do is, if you're comfortable, raise your hand if you identify with their position. So if you think that Joseph is one of these things and you're comfortable, raise your hand, okay? You don't have to raise your hand. No one from the church is watching you, I hope. Okay, so first I'd like to introduce Dan Vogel. He will be going first, and he is going to be representing the pious fraud position. So if any of you see Joseph as a pious fraud, you can raise your hand. That is more than I thought. Wow. Dan Vogel has been publishing in the field of early Mormon history for more than 30 years, authoring 11 books and 15 articles. Most notably, he is the editor of Early Mormon Documents, a five-volume series that won Best Documentary Awards from both the Mormon History Association and the John Whitmer Historical Association, and author of the award-winning Joseph Smith, The Making of a Prophet. Position two, the sincere visionary. Does anyone see Joseph as a sincere visionary? It's like kind of where I am. Will be presented by Ann Taves. She is a professor of religious studies at UC Santa Barbara and author of Revelatory Events, Experiences and Appraisals in the Emergence of New Spiritual Paths, which is forthcoming from Princeton, which discusses early Mormonism as one of three case studies. And we're lucky to have her today. Then position three will be argued by Christopher C. Smith, Joseph as the con man. So, ooh, some hands shot up. Okay, Christopher C. Smith is a PhD candidate at Claremont Graduate University and is currently completing a dissertation on early Mormon views of Native Americans. He is the author of a dozen peer-reviewed articles, including one in a recent issue of the Journal of Mormon History. He runs the Mormon Studies blog Worlds Without End at worldswithoutend.org. He's a fantastic human being. And then, last position, number four, will be Joseph as a prophet. Who sees Joseph as a prophet? This one you can tell your bishop about. So, that will be argued by Don. Don Bradley holds a bachelor's in history from Brigham Young University, and he did an internship with the Joseph Smith's Papers Project, and is finalizing his master's in history at Utah State University. Don's first book, The Lost 16 Pages, Rediscovering the Book of Lehi, is forthcoming from Greg Coford Books, and I love him so much. I'll let them get started.
Greetings, everybody. In his 1972 view of Von Brody's influential biography of Joseph Smith, No Man Knows My History, BYU professor Marvin S. Hill criticized her for ignoring the religious side of Smith's personality and portraying him as essentially irreligious. Brody says little about the rationalizations Joseph would have had to go through where his religious role was imposed upon him, Hill observed. Brody was never able to take us inside the mind of the prophet to understand how he thought and why. A reason for that may be that the sources she would have had to use were Joseph's religious writings, and her Smith was supposed to be irreligious. In my 1998 essay, The Prophet Puzzle Revisited, I suggested a model for understanding Joseph Smith and drew on his own writings to explain how he may have rationalized the ethical conflict of using God's name, of using deception in God's name. The model I wish to present for your consideration today is called pious fraud. This centuries-old term captures the dichotomous actions of people who feel justified in using deception to promote religion. Put simply, they believe the end justifies the means. Religious fraud has been with us for thousands of years. Religious forgery, in particular, also has a long history. From the fake discovery of the Book of Deuteronomy and the ruins of the temple in the 7th century BCE to the many pseudepigraphic or pseudonymous writings, such as the Assumption of Moses, the Book of Enoch, and the Ascension of Isaiah, generally dating from 200 BCE to CE 200, to the forged letters of the Apostles Peter and Paul within the present New Testament canon, as most recently discussed by Bart Ehrman, to the many forgeries of medieval monks and clerics, and finally to the Book of Mormon, as I maintain. The motivation for these pseudonymous authors, explains Ehrman, was to give their own religious views, often deemed heretical by the dominant group of believers, respectability and authority that otherwise would not be given an obscure author. Indeed, very few people outside his own family and small circle of friends would have wanted to read a theological book written by Joseph the money-digging farmer. That is, if he could get it published. As is evident, my model assumes the Book of Mormon is not real or genuine history and tries to explain why Joseph Smith wrote it. So those who insist Joseph Smith was sincere because the Nephites really existed will have difficulty participating in this discussion. Rather, this discussion is presently ongoing among non-believers trying to come to terms with Joseph Smith's possible motives, as well as some believers whose faith is liberal enough to allow that a prophet might very well dictate inspired pseudepigrapha and use deception to promote it. Since my introduction of the term pious fraud into Mormon vocabulary, the most vehement criticism has come from so-called Reformed Mormons, who flatly reject the term pious when referring to Joseph Smith. Their aversion to this term is equal to the believer's reaction to my use of fraud. To them, he was nothing but a malignant narcissist who cared only about himself and the acquisition of wealth, power, and sexual conquest. Joseph Smith was anything but pious, they assert. Of course, I would not argue that Joseph Smith was pious. He never made that claim himself. My argument is that his motive, or at least his chief motive for producing the Book of Mormon and founding the church, was pious. My purpose is to present a more sympathetic and complex way of viewing Joseph Smith. Indeed, I allow that Joseph Smith may have had more than one motive and that his motives were fluid over time. As historiographer David Hackett Fisher argues, in the realm of consciousness, a man who does something does it for every reason he can think of, and a few unthinkable reasons as well. Fisher also speaks of motivational pluralism and mentions psychologist Abraham Maslow's hierarchies of motivation. Robert Jones Schaefer, in his Guide to Historical Method, warns, psychology has not agreed on a single theory of human personality. It gives us insights, but not answers. Historians thus will be cautious about blanket assessment of human motivation to self-interest, the will to dominate, or altruism. Motive is difficult to ascertain, to be sure. As Fisher explains, there can be no primary direct evidence of any past motive, but there is a tacit logic of inference which can attain a high degree of plausible accuracy. In my 1998 essay, I not only argued that Joseph Smith was a pious fraud, but that Smith really believed he was called of God to preach repentance to a sinful world, and that he felt justified in using deception to accomplish his mission more fully. I would clarify this to include the idea that he believed what he produced was inspired, and that his use of deception to promote it was approved by God through revelation. Usually, those who question my thesis do so from the hindsight of Joseph's later actions, his apparent womanizing, money schemes, and lust for power, as if these were his intentions from the start. This simply isn't true. In fact, when he began to dictate the Book of Mormon in 1828, none of what came later was even contemplated. He didn't even envision himself as the founder of a new church, but saw his mission as a reformer of the existing churches through the Book of Mormon. In March 1829, a month before he began dictating the Book of Mormon to Oliver Cowdery, he dictated a revelation, now DNC 5, to Martin Harris, which said, "And he has a gift to translate the book, and I have commanded him that he should pretend to no other gift, for I will grant unto him no other gift." For obvious reasons, this was changed in 1835 to read, "And you have a gift to translate the plates, and this is the first gift that I bestowed upon you, and I have commanded that you should pretend to no other gift until my purpose is fulfilled in this, for I will grant unto you no other gift until it is finished." In a deleted section of the same revelation, it declares, If the people of this generation harden not their hearts, I will work a reformation among them, and I will establish my church, like unto the church which was taught by my disciples in days of old. Hence, there were no plans for a new church and no hierarchy in which to become powerful. His only ambition was to publish the Book of Mormon. Of course, things changed in the process of dictating, and the nature of Smith's mission evolved and expanded. So how did Joseph Smith find himself at the top of a hierarchical power structure when, according to David Whitmer, the early church was more egalitarian? The nature of charismatically established groups is that they will either quickly institutionalize or splinter and self-destruct due to challenges and competition from other charismatics within the group, which happened repeatedly in the early days of Smith's church. So the question arises, was Joseph Smith motivated by the acquisition of power, or did the nature of his role and the evolving situations create the need for it? I think the answer is probably both, but in a way, not like any institution. Besides, the acquisition of power and wealth may be necessary to better promote the intended good, especially if that good included being the leader of a communal society, of which there were many examples in the 19th century. Joseph Smith may have been guilty of spiritually and sexually abusing some of his female followers. He may have misappropriated church funds. He may have loved power. But none of these are evidence that he didn't have pious intentions when he sat down to dictate the Book of Mormon. Responding to Jan Shipp's complaint that the Book of Mormon has, by and large, been neglected as a source which might facilitate a better understanding of Joseph Smith's early career, Lutheran minister Robert N. Hullinger, in his 1980 book, Mormon Answer to Skepticism, Why Joseph Smith Wrote the Book of Mormon, attempted to discover Smith's motives by examining the book's rhetoric, and concluded, Joseph Smith regarded himself as a defender of God and intended the Book of Mormon to be apologetic for Jesus Christ. Even if one holds Smith was the worst scoundrel of his day, he argued, one still must account for the content of the Book of Mormon. I prefer to put the best construction on Smith, he continued. Let his expressed motives speak for themselves, then draw conclusions from the evidence. That approach does not rule out a negative opinion of Joseph Smith, but it allows for a more charitable estimate of his intentions. Indeed, the book's religious appeal, its defense of God, Jesus Christ, and spiritual gifts, and its call to repentance, argue strongly that Joseph Smith's motives were at least in part pious. Moreover, would an insincere fraud challenge readers to pray about his book? Not likely. Those who reject the pious fraud model based on their diagnosis that Joseph Smith was a malignant narcissist who was incapable of truly caring for others are overly confident in their ability to diagnose the dead, and are under the misapprehension that narcissistic personality disorder is an absolute category. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders lists 9 traits that are characteristic of NPD, lack of empathy being one of them, and requires at least 5 of the criteria to be present. Another problem with this diagnosis is that most leaders and successful people have narcissistic personality traits like grandiosity and the need for admiration without having the disorder. Again, pious fraud does not require Joe Smith to be truly pious or devoid of any self-interest. Can a narcissist think his actions are beneficial to others? Certainly. In fact, they are likely to think that because they are such a gift to mankind, they deserve to be treated special by them. While the pious fraud thesis does not require Joseph Smith's every act to be pure, those who see Joseph Smith as a simple fraud or total narcissist incapable of genuinely caring for others will have to explain away every example of his sincerity or empathy for others as a mere act or pretense, or else withdraw this argument. Examples of Joseph Smith's caring for others caused Robert D. Anderson to qualify his NPD diagnosis, admitting that the narcissistic personality and its varied forms and mixtures with other personality issues can be capable of different degrees of concern and worry for others. Obviously, Dr. Anderson's NPD diagnosis cannot be used to dismiss the pious fraud theory. In my view, those who see Joe Smith as a narcissistic, power-hungry, wealth-seeking, womanizing pedophile are as guilty of creating a two-dimensional character as those who portray him as a saintly prophet who merely spoke the words God gave him. The pious use of deception is something that appears in the Bible. Jacob fooling his blind father Isaac into giving him the firstborn blessing instead of his brother Esau, for example. And it appears in Joseph Smith's writings as well. In my 1998 essay, I explored examples of Joseph Smith's teachings that either broached morally gray areas or would have aided him in justifying an act such as pious fraud. 1. DNC 19, given in March 1830, reveals that Joseph Smith was secretly a believer in universal salvation and therefore would not have feared punishment for his pious deception. 2. DNC 19 also says that the terms eternal punishment and endless punishment are synonyms for God's punishment, and that punishment is not eternal after all. But God uses those terms to mislead and frighten his children into repenting. 3. The Book of Mormon teaches what is known as the fortunate fall. In other words, Adam's fall was in accordance with God's will, and therefore was a good thing, because in breaking one commandment, Adam was able to accomplish a greater good. 4. In the Book of Mormon, Nephi hesitates to kill the drunken and defenseless Laban, arguing with the Spirit, "Never at any time have I shed the blood of man." The Spirit reissues the command and reasons with Nephi, "Slay him, for the Lord hath delivered him into thy hands. Behold, the Lord slayeth the wicked to bring forth his righteous purposes. It is better that one man should perish than that a whole nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief." Thus, Nephi crossed a moral line to accomplish a greater good. As Nephi is apparently one of Joseph Smith's alter egos, I would suggest that this reflects his own moral struggle. 5. In Genesis, Abraham fears for his life and lies to Pharaoh, saying that Sarah was his sister rather than his wife. This was only half true, but he lived to father a great nation as God had promised. However, in Joseph Smith's Book of Abraham, God tells Abraham to lie. 6. In attempting to coax the 20-year-old Nancy Rigdon into secretly becoming a plural wife in 1842, Joseph Smith argued that that which is right under one circumstance may be and often is right under another. Whatever God requires is right, no matter what it is, although we may not see the reason thereof till long after the events transpire. My conclusion in 1998 was modest. We may never know exactly Smith's reasoning, but we can at least say that if he wrote the Book of Mormon, became a prophet, and founded the church as a pious deception, it is evident that he had the psychological means of justifying such acts. Thanks for listening.
I'm already. I'll just do it this way, I think. Okay. So in today's discussion, I got invited to defend the position that Smith was a sincere visionary. And I'm doing so today not because I'm necessarily totally convinced that he was, but because as a scholar of religion, I think that this possibility has been underexplored given the polarizations that tend to emerge between believers and non-believers or ex-believers. And so let me start by indicating how I would differentiate the sincere visionary position from the others as I imagine they're going to be presented, because we didn't trade our papers ahead of time. So I'm assuming that in contrast to the true prophet position, which I'm guessing will entail defending the supernatural claim that God called Smith as a prophet, I'm not making any supernatural claims regarding Smith or actually anybody else for that matter. In relation to the con man position, I'm going to argue that Smith was pious, albeit not conventionally so. And to me, the con man position reflects, it's a highly polemical stance that tends to reflect and rely heavily on his critics' positions. And then third, in contrast to the pious fraud position, which you just heard, which I find much more plausible, I want to see if we can explain the evidence that typically gives rise to claims of fraud, delusion, or deception in more neutral, albeit still naturalistic, terms. Now, in talking about the evidence, I relied more on Dan's making the introduction to making of a prophet, where he rehearses the evidence there that's a little bit different from what he did in his prophet puzzle article. So the evidence that I picked up on is a little different from what he just gave us. So I'm going to start by talking about at least the evidence that I'm going to deal with, which may not be all the evidence, but okay. So potential evidence for conscious deception or fraud. First of all, Dan at least and some others have talked about his use of seer stones as a potential argument for deception or fraud. So if the seer stones had no special powers and there was no buried treasure that got away, then Smith must have been using them, this argument would go, as a magician or a charlatan might use a prop in a performance. This in turn raises questions about Smith's use of the seer stone to translate the golden plates. Was it not simply a prop there too? And if it was a prop, then how exactly did he produce the so-called translation? Second, the existence of the golden plates as an objective artifact. Vogel and quite a few others cite this as the most obvious evidence of conscious deception. In this approach, ancient golden plates either existed or they did not. If there were plates, then Smith was who he claimed to be. If there were no plates and Smith knew it, then he had to have consciously deceived his followers in order to convince them that plates existed. And if there were no plates, but he believed there were, then he was deluded. Third, his recognized capacity for deception. Dan notes his repeated public denial of his own and others' plural marriages during the early 40s. But if we assume that Smith made the golden plates, hid them in a box or under a cloth, and said that the Lord said that others could not look at them directly, then this could be construed as deception as well. In his 1831 letters, Ezra Booth, who was already an ex-Mormon by that time, indicates that only a select few were allowed to witness Smith receiving new revelations or producing his inspired translations, which, if not deceptive, suggests to me, anyway, that we could argue that there was something there to hide. And then I would also add, and this is just a personal thing that kind of bugs me, is that endless circular logic. We see this initially in Smith's explanations of why the treasure got away and why he couldn't retrieve the golden plates, but Ezra Booth offers numerous further examples, such as to explaining failed revelatory claims or miracles in a circular fashion and justifying his singular authority in a similar way. Now, to go fast, potential evidence of delusion. You can basically take anything that he claimed that you don't believe was true and argue, and people have argued that it's evidence of delusion. I got to move fast or I won't get to what I want to argue. So my approach is to take these different pieces of evidence for him being deluded or a fraud and rearrange them to come at it in a different way. So I want to ask two broad questions. First, what was going on with the seer stone? And then what about the materiality of the plates and the lies? So in relation to the seer stone question, I want to consider Smith's belief in supernatural gifts, seer stones, and the reality of angels, treasure, and golden plates in light of research on unusual but not supernatural abilities, and also placebo effects. And then I'll then consider his claims regarding the ancient golden plates, his capacity to deceive, and his circular logic in relation to other branches of Christianity. So let's start with what was going on with the seer stone. The problem with the seer stone discussions, as I see it, is that they've been caught up in two problematic either-or distinctions. On the one hand, there are those who think that we have to choose between people either having supernatural gifts or people just having ordinary abilities. The other either-or is that the stones either had magical properties or the stones did nothing. In contrast, I'll argue that some people do have unusual natural abilities that they and others may believe are supernatural gifts, and that stones with believed-in powers can trigger effects in much the way believed-in pills trigger placebo effects. So I'm going to look at these two things here. In terms of Smith's unusual abilities, I would offer the following as likely possibilities. First of all, I think he had unusual visualization skills, an ability to visualize things that others could not see, which I think that he honed as a treasure seeker and carried over into translating, or more precisely, into dictating the Book of Mormon and other texts. Second, I think he had unusual storytelling ability, an ability to make that which he could visualize seem real to others and most likely also to himself. Believers and critics acknowledged this ability. The former viewed what he recounted as revelation, the latter as imagination or lies. Third, I think he had an ability to absorb information quickly and to elaborate a big picture from minimal cues, which he used this ability, I think, in creating oral narratives. So I'll just call these information processing skills. Fourth, and this is getting a little more technical, but you'll see why, I think he had an ability to control and manipulate attentional processes in such a way that the flow of words that he dictated while he was translating did not seem to be his own. We can see evidence of this ability in channelers, New Age channelers, who also dictate complex texts, and some novelists who have a sense that their characters come to life and tell the story. Now, hypnosis researchers have found a subset of hypnotic subjects, who they refer to as highly hypnotizable subjects, who can do some of the things that I was just describing in response to suggestion without going into deep trance or otherwise altered states of consciousness. And these researchers are using neuroimaging to better understand the ability of highly hypnotizable subjects to control and manipulate attentional processes in order to do this. I think that Smith Searstone may have cued a shift in his attentional processes, allowing him to enter a mode in which he visualized objects, first as a treasure seeker, and later sensed a flow of words in his mind that he then dictated to a scribe. Power belief. I think that Smith's abilities were enhanced by his beliefs and by suggestions from those that he trusted. The power of belief and suggestion to affect changes is well attested by research on the effect of placebos, that is, on objects and procedures that are believed to have intrinsic properties that, in fact, the subjects attribute to them. So just as pills with no active ingredients can trigger actual healing in a patient who responds to the doctor's assurances that this pill will help them feel better, so too I think that Smith's family's beliefs about the power of seer stones created a believed-in object that triggered and allowed Smith to hone his visualization abilities. Thus, I think it's possible that Smith's seer stones afforded seeing or visualizing in much the same way that a placebo affords healing. But, okay, also then suggestion. In placebo effects, the clinical setting, and they don't usually talk about this, is highly important. The physician's authority and assurances and the patient's trust in these assurances all play an important role. If we transfer this whole situation out into the everyday real world, I would argue that I think that Smith's father's statement that Joseph's 1823 dream vision was of God the next morning convinced him that the angel and the plates were real and not simply a dream, and enabled him to visualize but not recover the plates. Okay, so what then about the materiality of the golden plates? Here I'm going to shift my line of argument and basically argue that I think we have to take pains to play fair with Mormonism relative to other forms of Christianity. If we want to argue that all Christians or all religious believers are deluded, that's cool. But I think we should take care not to single out Mormonism if there are no non-polemical grounds on which to do so. So, with respect to the golden plates, I think that Dan and others who speculate that Smith made the plates himself, I think they're probably right. But then we need to ask whether there was any way he could have done this and still thought the plates were real. So I've argued at length elsewhere that I think there's evidence to suggest that Smith ultimately realized that, like Jared's brother and like Dominic Crossan argued last night about Jesus in relation to John the Baptist, I think that Smith may have realized that he had to actively materialize an object in faith rather than passively waiting for it to be given to him ready-made, as it were. This more active course, I'm hypothesizing, involved creating plates, perhaps using sand, and later tin or lead, as his detractors claimed. In contrast to his detractors, however, I'm postulating that Smith could have made plates in the knowledge that they would become the sacred reality the Smith family believed them to be, that is, ancient golden plates, only insofar as the Lord or an angel made them so. So, although good Calvinists, such as Joseph's uncle Jesse Smith, would view the making of a sacred object as idolatry, the wider Christian tradition offers a number of other ways we might think about this, including the way that Eucharistic wafers are thought to be transformed by a Catholic priest into the literal body of Christ. In contrast to Vogel, I think that the logic may have been less like an adept deceiving his subjects and more like a Catholic priest making Christ really present in the Eucharistic wafer. In the first case, the adept knowingly misleads his viewers, albeit for their own good. In the second case, a priest holds up an object that looks like a wafer to all of us and proclaims, based on actions taken by him and beliefs that Catholics hold about these actions, that the wafer is, in fact, the body of Christ. Comparison of the golden plates and the Eucharist allows us to consider the possibility that Smith viewed something that he made, tin plates, as a vehicle through which something sacred, ancient golden plates, could be made really present. In both cases, the sacred reality is visible only to those who believe. In both cases, the materialization unfolds in accord with the story. In the case of the Eucharist, the story of the Last Supper. In the case of the Mormon prophet, the story of the angel and the buried plates. Moreover, in both cases, believers claim that it's not just an enactment. The priest doesn't just pretend the wafer is the body of Christ. Standing in for Christ, he says, "This is my body." Nor did Smith claim that the plates were a representation of ancient golden plates. He claimed that they really were. If we consider Joseph's directive that people couldn't look at the plates, the obedient response of insiders, and their willingness to protect the plates from skeptical outsiders, we can envision an alternative way to view the materialization of the plates that involved neither recovery and translation in any usual sense, nor necessarily deception or fraud, but rather a process through which a small group who believed in the power of revelatory dream visions in ancient inhabitants of the Americas and in golden records buried in a hillside came to venerate a material object covered by a cloth or hidden in a box that they believed were the ancient plates revealed to Joseph Smith by the ancient Nephite Moroni. Either or views of the plates rest on a narrow conception of the materialization process, such that he either dug them up or he did not. Highlighting the crucial role played by those who believed in the reality of the ancient plates suggests a broader view that embeds the recovery of the plates in a process of materialization that most likely, I would say, stretched from his dream vision in 1823 until the publication of the Book of Mormon. So what then about the lies and circular logic? Okay, I'll be quick here. Smith's denial of plural marriage, when he and a few in the inner circles were practicing it, parallels Ezra Booth's claim that only a select few were allowed to witness the reception of revelations or his work on the inspired translations. In all these cases, something is going on that is limited to a select few in an inner circle, which Smith either doesn't want others to observe or he wants to deny altogether. In other words, there are secrets, beliefs and practices accessible only to a select few in an inner circle. This is actually a classic definition of an esoteric tradition of the sort we see historically in esoteric and Platonized forms of Christianity. But they get labeled esoteric there. They don't get labeled lies and deception. Circular logic. Well, I'm going to be even quicker on this. I think it's hard to escape in any religious tradition. And I'll just tell you a couple-sentence story that my father tells. When he was in the Navy, he was a kind of devout evangelical. And on the ship, he tells the story of trying to convert a Mormon. And the point of the story, though, is that when he backed the Mormon into a corner, my dad realized that the Mormon shipmate was using the exact same arguments to get himself out of the corner my dad had backed him into as my dad used to back himself out of the same corners that he got into as an evangelical. So I think this is not logic that we can single out on the part of Mormons. And then finally, can we distinguish, the final bit here is, oh, yeah, but wasn't he at least deluded? So here I would make the same argument, and I'm going to make it really fast, that Dan was making about narcissistic personality disorder and all the stuff in the DSM. There's actually, even though we use delusion all the time in popular use, there's actually a technical definition of this, which has an exemption for religious beliefs that are prevalent in the culture. So basically, the philosophers of science who then try and make sense out of all this have struggled really hard to make a distinction between ordinary beliefs and delusions. And they've confessed to failing, except to make a distinction on any intrinsic grounds. The only grounds they can make it on are contexts and symptoms of psychopathology. Symptoms of psychopathology, you got to go back to the DSM, like Dan was quoting. So it basically means that the minute you get other people to believe your beliefs, you're getting outside the realm of the definition of delusion. And so we've got this pivot point here, right? Of once Joseph Smith starts getting other people to believe what he believes, we have the founder of a new religious movement. We no longer have someone who is totally isolated in their beliefs. So here's my conclusion, that we're talking about an interactive developmental process that was a small group process. We're not just talking about Joseph Smith all by himself. And that it's not just an either-or choice. So I'm arguing that we've got more options, and that this discussion has continued to be overly polarized because so much of it has taken place between people who believe and people who don't believe. And this was my attempt to give you a religious studies perspective.
Joseph Smith was born into a petty crime family. How's that for an opening line? By the way, I'm going to say some deliberately provocative things here, but I'm not speaking out of malice. My goal is just to tell an interesting story in a way that you've never heard it before, and you can make of it what you will. And if any of this is hard to listen to, remember Don's up next. He's going to save the day. Okay, so petty crime family. His mother's second cousin was arrested for counterfeiting, and Joseph Smith Sr. seems to have narrowly escaped a counterfeiting conviction in 1807 by turning state's evidence. And in Palmyra, the Smiths' neighbors knew them as money diggers and knew them for stealing chickens and stealing other people's milk, milking their cows, and so forth. In the 1820s, Joseph read the memoirs of counterfeiter and con man Stephen Burroughs, as well as stories about pirate Captain Kidd. And he also practiced his own confidence games on his neighbors. He convinced them that with a seer stone that he stole from his neighbor Sally Chase, he could find buried treasure. On the promise of treasure, there was no treasure, but on the promise of treasure, they gave him money, food, and transportation. For instance, Joshua Stafford once gave him a sheep that he sacrificed in order to appease a treasure guardian, and that night the Smiths feasted on mutton. And I could tell you several stories like that. Thing is, the Smiths were poor. An 1829 visitor said that they ate rye bread for supper and burned through the only candle in the house that night. Stolen chickens and sacrificed sheep provided some protein, but Joseph dreamed of a really big score to lift his family out of poverty. So he came up with the Gold Bible. From the beginning, the Gold Bible was a for-profit enterprise. The Smiths often talked to their friends and neighbors about how much money they were going to make through this scheme. And the scam, as far as I've been able to figure it out, is Joseph would convince people that he had these plates, but he wasn't allowed to show anybody them yet. And he would publish a translation of the book and make a lot of money from selling, you know, copies of the book. And then with that money, he would actually forge a believable facsimile of golden plates, and he would exhibit those to tourists for a fee, for 25 cents a viewing. In Martin Harris, Joseph found the perfect mark for this scheme. The first time they met, Joseph said that God had promised him that the first honest man he met would give him $50, and Martin forked over the money. Here was a man of means that Joseph could manipulate. Joseph played on Martin's religiosity, but also on his greed. Martin was an investor. He mortgaged his farm for $3,000, and Joseph promised to quadruple that investment. But then Joseph received a revelation in 1830 that Martin was a wicked man and shouldn't get any of the profits. When Joseph sent people to sell the Canadian copyright of the Book of Mormon for $8,000, he told them to keep it secret from Martin. And a revelation designated the proceeds for the exclusive benefit of the Smith family. Dan Vogel argues that Joseph Smith was a pious fraud. I'm going to argue that he was an impious fraud motivated by money, sex, and power. Joseph probably did have some religious beliefs, but I don't think that religion motivated the fraud. If anything, I actually think it held him back a little bit. And we can see that in the quote that Dan gave us about Joseph saying that he was going to give up the seer stone as soon as he was done with translating the Book of Mormon, because his family, particularly his in-laws, gave him a really hard time about the seer stones and so forth. And in 1827, he admitted to his father-in-law that peeping was all damn nonsense and promised to give it up and work hard for a living. And he briefly tried to keep this promise, moved to Pennsylvania, became a farmer, joined the Methodists, and then Oliver Cowdery showed up and convinced him to not only finish the Book of Mormon, but start a church. Joseph also wrestled with his demons a bit as he composed the Book of Mormon, and you can see this because the Book of Mormon condemns all of the things that he later becomes guilty of, all of his personal temptations, from polygamy and adultery to robbery, priestcraft, and murder. But ultimately, Joseph's beliefs shifted to fit his criminal behavior rather than his behavior shifting to fit his beliefs. By 1830, he was a universalist like Niebuhr, and by 1841, he was a moral nihilist like Korihor. He preached in 1841 that there was no sin where there was no accuser. In other words, anything goes as long as you don't get caught. He also taught that you have a right to get all you can. Morality probably didn't come naturally to Joseph Smith. A psychiatrist might diagnose him with antisocial personality disorder, which we colloquially know as psychopathy. One mark of a psychopath is uninterrupted eye contact. So normal people feel really uncomfortable with eye contact and they'll look away every few seconds, but a psychopath can just like stare you down. And one author of a book on sociopaths calls this the predator stare. And sustained eye contact is actually part of the psychopath's power because it makes them seem very charming and mysterious and seductive, because normal people are just baffled by this power that they have to just make sustained eye contact. And so Parley Pratt described Joseph as having he described the serene and steady penetrating glance of Joseph Smith's eye as if he would probe the deepest abyss of the human heart and the mysteries of the universe. And both Stephen Harding and Joseph Jackson also said that the prophet stared steadily into their eyes. And to Joseph Jackson, Joseph Smith said, "Jackson, you are the first man I have ever met that I could not look down." Joseph Jackson was probably also a psychopath. Now look around the room and spot the psychopath. Every person I've told this to has either tried to stare me down or they've looked around really sometimes. Joseph didn't often show his true face. Fraud doesn't weigh on a psychopath the way that it weighs on a normal person. But once in a while, he couldn't resist a brag. Squire Butler once told Joseph he was astonished that a man of his appearance would attempt to palm off on the public a book which contains so many absurdities as the Book of Mormon. Joseph fired back, "I am astonished that a man of your intelligence don't know that the more absurdities there is connected with it, the readier people are to embrace it." In 1831, Joseph moved to Kirtland. Here, his activities took on an even more criminal aspect. He began developing a theology of theft, which for the rest of his life he would use to get his followers to engage in criminal activity. An 1831 revelation said, "I will consecrate the riches of the Gentiles unto my people who are of the house of Israel." Joseph also called this sucking the milk of the Gentiles, according to Newell K. Whitney's brother. One way he sucked the milk of the Gentiles was by printing his own money. He may have had a counterfeiting operation as early as 1834, run by Marvel Davis, But then in 1836, he realized that he didn't even need to break the law to print his own money, so he starts the Kirtland Bank. And basically, the Kirtland Bank created money and stock out of thin air and made large cash payouts to Joseph and Sidney without them ever actually depositing money into their accounts. Martin Harris called the bank a swindle, which was about right, and when the bank failed, church members bore most of the losses while church leaders jumped ship, transferred all their stock to a couple Fall Guys, and denied any responsibility for the bank or its failure. Joseph took a darker turn in 1835 when he decided to assassinate anti-Mormon Grandison Newell. First, Joseph asked Leonard Rich to kill Newell, but Rich refused. So then Joseph approached gunsmith Marvel Davis and his house servant, Solomon Denton, and told them that the murder was a great work and the will of heaven, and they would be rewarded, and that once they killed Newell, they should hide the body. So Davis and Denton went to Newell's house. They saw him on his porch. Marvel Davis aimed his rifle at Newell, but he couldn't go through with it. He couldn't pull the trigger. And so they went back to Joseph, and Joseph told them he wished to God the deed had been done and hoped it wouldn't be given up. Later, Newell got wind of all of this, and he pressed charges against Joseph Smith for attempted murder in 1837. Before the trial, Joseph reportedly approached the assassins and asked them not to testify. Denton went ahead and testified, but Davis skipped the state. For lack of evidence, Joseph was acquitted. But outside of court, both Davis and Leonard Rich confirmed that Joseph had attempted to recruit them for the assassination. Also, Apostles Orson Hyde and Luke Johnson, who were both in good standing at the time, both testified at the trial that they had heard Joseph say that it was the will of God that Newell should be put where the crows could not find him. So we have five witnesses who implicate Joseph Smith for this attempted murder, including two apostles in good standing. In 1838, Joseph and Sidney fled to far west Missouri. And in Missouri, Joseph organizes a group called the Danites, or the Daughter of Zion. Both these names come from biblical passages about Israelites stealing from the Gentiles and slaughtering them. The names imply that Joseph specifically designed the Danites as a robber band. Like the Gadiantans of the Book of Mormon, the Danites covenanted to lie, steal, and murder. They swore absolute obedience to the First Presidency, right or wrong, and they swore to put down all tattling and backbiting against church leaders. At one Danite meeting, Sidney Rigdon made the whole assembly swear to kill Gentiles and apostates on sight and throw their bodies into the brush. Rigdon claimed that one Gentile had already been murdered. On another occasion, Joseph, Hiram, and Sidney took 10 Danites outside the city and taught them that stealing from Gentiles was no sin, and if they got caught and put on trial, they should swear to a lie or do whatever else might be necessary to help each other out of trouble. The entire Danite theology, essentially, was designed to motivate criminal behavior. In fact, the Danite initiation ceremony was an early version of the temple endowment, complete with signs, penalties, grips, and keywords. Mormonism's most sacred ordinance originated right here as a ritual induction into a criminal conspiracy. The ceremony used a powerful combination of religious indoctrination, fraternal bonding, sacred oaths, and death threats to get normal, good-hearted people to do bad things. This wasn't criminal activity used in the service of religion. This was religion used in the service of criminal activity. Another tool in Joseph's motivational toolkit was blackmail. When he made polygamous marriage proposals, he sometimes told the women that he proposed to that he would ruin their reputations if they told anyone. And he actually did publish smears of women like Nancy Rigdon and Sarah Pratt, calling them whores and adulteresses. He also used the same tactics against male dissenters. In one sermon, he announced that he would publicly disgrace every man who didn't shut up and mind his own business. And in the Nauvoo City Council, once when Francis Higbee had warned William Law and William Marks that Joseph was going to assassinate them, Joseph told Higbee he should stay home and shut his mouth or else he would find the rumor mill turning against him. In 1838, Joseph's Danite shenanigans got him locked up, and while he was in jail, his brother William remarked to Heber C. Kimball, "Joseph ought to have been hung up by the neck years ago, and damn him, he will get it now." But William didn't get his wish because Joseph escaped and fled to Nauvoo. I'm running out of time here, so I won't say as much about Nauvoo, but basically, suffice to say, he secretly married 40 women, coordinated more robberies, counterfeiting, and assassinations, and continued to profit from his church office. In fact, in Nauvoo, he was the trustee and trust, and essentially all the church property for a few years was in his own name. One thing that Mormon historians say about Joseph is that he was a bad judge of character because all of his Nauvoo friends were criminals, basically. Personally, I think Joseph was a great judge of character and knew exactly how corrupt his friends were. For instance, he met Joseph Jackson, and a couple days after he meets Joseph Jackson, he records in his journal that Jackson is rotten-hearted. And then a few months later, he makes Jackson his personal aide-de-camp. Joseph Smith also appointed three Gentiles to the Council of 50, two of them known counterfeiters and one the inventor of a steam-powered flamethrower that Joseph wanted to buy the designs for. These dodgy Gentiles didn't get into the inner circle by accident. Joseph recruited them precisely because they had criminal expertise that he wanted to make use of. So to conclude, Joseph was basically a crook masquerading as a prophet, and he was very successful at it. By the end of his life, he had moved his family from the poorhouse to the mansion house, and he'd built a sprawling criminal organization designed as a church. Now, the story that I've just told is partly a cautionary tale. Turns out there are bad people in the world, and you have to be on your guard or you can get taken advantage of. And for me, this is counterintuitive because I'm actually a pretty trusting person. I like to believe the best about people, and so I've only sort of gradually moved from Dan's position to mine. And I think I've done it with some reluctance, despite a bit of admitted glee at sort of the craziness of all of this. But I think this can also be a hopeful story, because however bad Joseph was, his followers were mostly good and sincere people. And he may have founded Mormonism as a criminal front, but Mormons have made something very different out of it. So one way to look at Joseph's life is as the prologue to the much more ennobling story of how his followers have wrestled with his legacy and transformed it into something better. And Mormonism really is one of the great stories of institutional turnaround of the modern era. I mean, just how it went from the Mormonism of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young to the church that it is today is just an amazing story. So the good news is, the bad news is there are bad people, but the good news is that we collectively have the power to resist and redeem and transform whatever the bad people do. So go do that.
Bit of a disadvantage, since arguing that Joseph Smith was a prophet doesn't entail listing as many entertaining shenanigans. But Chris is actually a good friend of mine and a former roommate. We were roommates just a few years ago. And we were out to dinner the other night together, along with my very good friend, one of my best friends, Trevor Luke, and another best friend, Maxine Hanks. And Chris was giving a bit of a preview of his presentation and said he was going to use that bombshell word, psychopath. And so I told him, well, you know, I'm getting up right after you, and I'm going to get up and I'm going to say that Smith really is a psychopath. And, you know, this is Chris Smith, in case you didn't catch that. He told me that Chris has a good enough sense of humor that he told me that even though the joke was at his expense, I just had to use it because it was too good to not use. You'll notice later, if you talk with him, how long he stares into your eyes. He used to store mutton in his room. I'm not going to make any judgments. But it's actually very fitting that I've been placed last in these four positions, because at one time or another, I've held all of these positions, each one in succession. Just a few years back, actually, I held the impious fraud view that Chris holds, and pursued that for a few years quite avidly. It was my working model of Joseph Smith, and the questions that I asked about Joseph Smith were really grounded in that model. So everything that Joseph Smith did, every behavior of his, everything that came out of his mouth that I would examine, I would ask the question, and what was in it for him, right? And, you know, I could usually find something, right, that was in it for him. The model seemed to work quite well. It had explanatory power, so I continued to use it. Eventually, for a few reasons, ended up sort of expanding out the questions that I asked and found that, where the data that my attention was drawn to was really grounded in the questions that I was asking, that I was bringing to the data. And so if we were to ask, how could what Joseph Smith is doing in this instance have benefited his family, or how could it have served religious purposes where he would have seen himself as serving God, and then it puts a different cast on all of that. But when I switch away from that impious fraud model, I actually didn't give up all the things that I found in that model. I just added to them. And looking at a broader, bigger, complex Joseph Smith. So I think if I were to try to argue Joseph Smith as impious fraud, I could give you a run for your money, you know. We've traded positions. I do believe that Joseph Smith believed his own teachings and claims, but even Joseph Smith's sincerity actually isn't central to the arguments that I'm going to make today. Though there are definitely a number of things that have been said by their panelists, particularly you, Chris, that I disagree with and that I could argue against and argue again for more positive motives and for strengths of Joseph Smith that aren't recognized, certainly in the con man model. But I actually don't feel a need in arguing the position I'm going to argue today to deny anything that anyone else has said. We could take all the things that have been said, particularly all the things that you said, Chris, and I find them pretty much irrelevant to what I'm going to be arguing. Dr. Taves reasonably inferred that my argument that Joseph Smith as a prophet would entail arguing for the supernatural involvement in his life. But while one would usually argue that, I'm not going to. My fellow panelists have framed their arguments entirely within a naturalistic frame, and I'll do the same. I'm not going to attempt the completely fruitless task of trying to change people's worldview in a 15-minute presentation in order to argue that Joseph Smith is a prophet, nor, in fact, do I think that it's necessary to do that. So, to begin with, an obvious question is what constitutes a prophet? And didn't get the exact word-for-word definitions to read to you, but I looked at some definitions of a prophet, and a very obvious one is a religious leader or visionary. Obviously, that one, Joseph Smith, would fit, but it's not going to be a particularly controversial one. Another one is one who foretells the future, and I'll come back to that one. And then another very common definition is that a prophet is a messenger of God. So to start my arguments for Joseph Smith as a prophet, I'd actually go wider first and then come back to Joseph Smith and talk a little bit about human nature and talk about religion and how it factors into human nature. So we're all familiar with the nature versus nurture controversy, and there are various people who've deconstructed that one and shown that it's a false dichotomy because the way that genes express themselves really shaped by the environment. You know, for instance, epigenetics or an interaction between genes and environment. But I think there's a more basic reason to reject that dichotomy, and one that will be relevant here. Imagine, let's do just a little thought experiment. So take a member of our species, Homo sapiens, and drop her or him into the wilderness with this person having no cultural learning of any kind, nothing that they've ever learned from another human being, and like, let's watch how fast they die, right? Because human beings can't survive without cultural knowledge. Even feral children, you know, these rare feral children who manage to survive in the wilderness, usually were raised for at least their first few years by human parents and learned some skills and actions. And then they often pick up, maybe they're raised further by wolves or something, they copy behaviors from other species. We don't come wired with the necessary information and behaviors, instincts, sufficient for us to survive. Instead, in place of that, we come wired to learn things. We come wired for culture. This is, you know, because our species has relied on culture and technology so long. Homo erectus had fire for over a million years. This has shaped our nature. So it's part of our nature, actually, to be completed by culture. So because of that, because human nature is kind of made incomplete, right, and designed, so to speak, to be completed by culture, there are various possible human natures that we could come up with. If you were raised acculturated in the Nazi culture, right, you come out one way. If you were raised in the Yanomamo tribe, you know, something entirely different. If you're raised here in Salt Lake as a Latter-day Saint, it's something different again. One of the extraordinarily powerful tools that we have evolved are what we might call social technologies. And perhaps the most powerful of these is religion. It has this incredible power to motivate people, to bind groups of people together. And we can see this, obviously, in looking at history or current events or people that we may know. There are a lot of social scientists who have looked at different aspects of this. William Irons has looked at how religion provides what he calls hard-to-fake signals of commitment that help build trust within communities and bind groups together. Psychologist Jonathan Haidt has also looked at how religion binds groups of people together, and as part of his moral foundations theories, research on that, he's looked at what are the moral universals. If you look at all different cultures around the world, what are the factors of morality that they all, what are the sources of morality that they all see in common? And one of these is a distinctly religious or spiritual kind of emotion. It's the sense of sanctity. It's based on this idea that there's an unseen order that underlies nature and the community that we're part of, and that that order needs to be upheld, and that that order's sacred, and if we violate it, that's seen as disgusting, and it's seen as desecrating the sacred and jeopardizing the stability of the world. And the function, one of the big functions of this shared sense of sanctity, right? That within a culture, people consider the same thing sacred, is that, again, it, what he argues is that it binds people together. So religion, any religion, religion in general, certainly, tends to have logical implausibilities, moral flaws, and it not only has these, but it tends to sanctify them and then even enshrine them so that they become permanent cultural fixtures. So, like, why not just get rid of religion altogether? One obvious reason is that would be really hard to do. But another reason is that religion has this kind of unique power to motivate and to bind people together. So if religion is doing things we don't want, why reject that powerful social technology of religion altogether? Like if we had a vaccine for measles that had bad side effects, that's not a reason to get rid of vaccinations completely. It's a reason to find the best vaccine or to develop a new one. Sociologist of religion William Sims Bainbridge, along with Rodney Stark, wrote A Theory of Religion, which aimed to be a very comprehensive theory of how religion works and has been very successful and very influential. He's someone who is very concerned also with the long-term survival of the human race, and he sees religion as playing a key role in that. As Bainbridge sees it, someday our planet is going to be destroyed by an asteroid or something, and life on the planet at least is. And if we haven't gone out into the broader universe and colonized other worlds, then our species is doomed. But how do we get ourselves to undertake this ridiculously difficult task? And he argues that the only thing that would give people sufficient motive to do that is religion. So he believes that we need a sort of modern religion that would motivate us to go out into the galaxy and beyond. So bringing that around then to Mormonism and to Joseph Smith's theology, what kind of narrative does Mormonism give us to help sort of complete our human nature, to add to the basic biological instincts that are there and shape us? Mormonism gives the narrative, for one thing, that human beings have a divine identity, that divinity is in our spiritual DNA, as it were, and that we therefore have the potential to develop into full-fledged divine beings, into gods, or complete participants in God's own godhood. Now, I personally see a great deal that's compelling and a lot of peculiar theological power in the idea of Mormon idea of pre-existence. I think it helps with the problem of evil and suffering and the idea of continuity between the selves we have now and the selves we would be in the afterlife. But like you said before, I'm not here today to argue for the supernatural, so let's set that aside. Even without belief in a literal pre-existence, what that part of what that belief, Mormon belief that we are children, spirit children of God, does, he said, is it gives us this divine identity and this sense of divine potential. If you believe that you are divine in nature, then it makes all the more sense to strive to realize divine potential. It helps us, in other words, a narrative like that helps us to be more divine and to strive for divinity. So there are modern thinkers who are completely secular, let's take Ray Kurzweil, the big transhumanist thinker, came up with the idea of the singularity. when he's asked, does God exist, he always answers, not yet. Because he believes that humankind, as we continue to progress, we will gradually take on more and more essentially divine powers of knowledge and capacity and hopefully morality. Much more sober thinker, Martin Seligman, is the past president of the American Psychological Association and is famous for having developed the theory of learned helplessness, argues for the idea of a God who comes at the end. So he doesn't believe that God exists now, but he believes that as humankind progresses, if we go the right direction, right, there can be a God in the future. That's what humankind can develop into. Joseph Smith founded a religion that, shifting gears a little bit from that point, Joseph Smith founded a religion that centered more in an evolution that's guided by principles than one that's based on sort of fossilized precepts. So he taught the notion of continuing revelation, so that, you know, ideas that he taught earlier could be replaced later. He wasn't stuck on particular ideas. What was more important really was this process. Alma 32 in the Book of Mormon, when it talks about faith, I did a presentation on this recently, wish I could actually go over the text, but if you look at what it's doing in its use of an analogy, the analogy of faith as the growth of a seed, it plays on biblical parables that have to do with seeds and faith, but it makes, instead of faith being a passive thing where it's just something that you possess, it's something that you have to act on, and it requires, instead of faith being expressed as it is in the Sermon on the Mount by, like, take no thought what you shall do, it's actually in Alma 32, it's if you don't take thought to nourish the seed, then it's going to die. So the point, the use of the same exact phrase is used, which isn't used anywhere else in the canon except those places, is used with diametric opposite meaning. It's saying human beings have to take initiative, they have to take action. And so Joseph Smith has a religious vision that emphasizes process over fixed belief. So to kind of bring this together, prophet as a teller of the future. Joseph Smith doesn't, I would argue, foretell a definite future, like the world's going to end in 50 years, which is kind of useless information unless you just want to sort of eat, drink, and be merry, you know, as a result of that information. He tells us about possible futures, like building Zion or becoming like God, that we can achieve through our own effort. This, if I had time, I would actually relate this to Dr. Taves's ideas on the golden plates. Joseph Smith also, you know, if a prophet is a messenger of God, and Joseph Smith, even from a naturalistic point of view, God is seen as out there in the future, a possible outcome of the actions that we might take, potential, then Joseph Smith is a kind of prophet who, through whom God calls to us from the future, beckoning us to realize those potentials that are there. Did Joseph Smith encourage counterfeiting or participate in counterfeiting? Did Joseph Smith, I'm not totally convinced he did. Chris and I have talked about it maybe, you know, but like, did he make plates, right, himself? The the man not only believed that human deification was possible, but he made the achievement of human deification the very goal of religion itself. And so I think without spilling over into arguing for the supernatural at all, I think we can argue that Joseph Smith is one who foretells possible futures that are useful and that beckon to us, and that he speaks to us as a messenger of God, at the very least, the God who might be if we were to pursue that potential. Thank you.
So whoever can get up here first, we have a winner.
I'd like to thank Chris. This is not on. I'd like to thank Chris for being so clear and precise. Don, I didn't understand a single thing you said. I think we should give you 1 minute to clarify.
Do we have a question? One question? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, this is for Dr. Fix. You hinted a little bit about the fact that there were people that had paranormal abilities. Were you just saying that something that you actually believe that, or was it more of your argument that you were trying to present? And in that case, what do you think of the James Randi $1 million challenge? And why aren't these people stepping forward, taking the money, and if nothing else, shutting up people that don't believe in paranormal activity?
Yeah. I didn't use the word paranormal because I wasn't. I
wasn't talking about paranormal abilities. I'm just saying that in the general population, we have a range of abilities. In the same way that, you know, all of us can run, but we're not necessarily going to make it to the Olympics. And so this, I mean, I think that abilities. Visualization abilities, the kind of abilities that highly hypnotizable subjects have, those are replicatable, they're studied by researchers. They don't have the same kinds of problems as, you know, say, telepathy and some of the mind-mind transfers type stuff of parapsychology. So I wasn't going there.
Okay, I think we can, do you want to fit in one more? Let's fit in one more. Anyone else have a question?
Yeah.
We have till 6:30.
So this is for whoever wants to respond to it, but I read through Joseph Smith's journals, and in the portions where, the early portions, there are moments when prayers seem to interject randomly into the text of the journals. And to me, I found this a little bit disturbing as a sort of modern reader, but it does sort of support for me the view that he was a sort of visionary, honest person, because I don't know what else could motivate somebody to just randomly pray in their journal. It's really weird.
Yeah. That question seems like it's addressed to me. So I recently talked to Mark Ashton from me about this, and I'll tell you what I told him, which is, number one, there's always an audience present when he's writing the journal, so there's always a scribe in the room, and so he has a motive to, you know, convince that person. But also, the journals were not really designed to private documents. They were designed as public documents, and when Joseph talks about his journals and his histories, he talks about them as if they are his modern-day record, much like the Book of Abraham or Book of Moses. You know, this is his counterpart. This is the record of the last dispensation. And so I think that these are performance pieces.
I'm going to say to Chris, that as he's walking through all these various sources, just quoting, I didn't detect any critical stance towards some of these sources. Some of them are really out there. So, I'd just like to hear a little more critical use of resources.
That's fair. I mean, in a 15-minute discussion, unfortunately, you don't have time for a lot of that sort of discussion. But, you know, if I were to publish an article, I would certainly do a lot more engagement. And, like, for instance, the Squire Butler quote that I quoted, where Joseph Smith says, you know, the more absurdities there are, the more willing people are to believe it. Like, that's a secondhand, you know, source, and I really want that quote to be authentic.
I'm all take a bit of a stab at the question. And I think when I was pursuing actually a very similar model as Chris was, I would have argued the same thing, that it seems like Joseph Smith is on more than he's off, right? He feels sort of on stage even when it's a relatively quiet setting. So I don't think you can necessarily tell from what is in his journals alone. I think we would need to look at broader patterns of his behavior, and I think you can infer motives from that. And sometimes that he has self-serving motives, that's part of being a human being. And sometimes he seems to have very other-oriented and spiritual motives. And I think in mind of some of Dr. Hayes's arguments, if you look actually at how Joseph Smith might have been constructing his own private esoteric understandings of some of the things that he's saying publicly, I think some of those actually have a great deal of explanatory power. And then the question is, if Joseph Smith's just trying to pull something over other people's eyes, why does he privately need an esoteric explanation for himself to explain his claims and how they actually work?
There was one more question. One last. Yes.
It sounds like the mic isn't working, so if I understand your...
Yes, it's great.
This is for Chris. Chris, your approach seems to be the most cynical. Really, the only motivating factors are power, money, and sex, maybe, but power and money. And as a psychopath or sociopath, Joseph would really be without a conscience, and he would be driven by his motives would all be selfish. So I'm wondering how you would explain or at least account for in your theory Joseph decided to cross back over the river again and to turn himself.
Question. Yeah, so he asked, what do I do with Joseph's decision to cross back over the river into Nauvoo after he had run away from Nauvoo? I mean, I think that Joseph didn't know that he was going to get killed, you know? I mean, I think that he thought that he could survive this episode. To some extent, he was looking at the possibility of followers abandoning him, losing followers over his decision to flee. And so when he gets wind that his followers are really discontented with this decision, that's when he goes back. And so it's a strategic decision as much as anything else, I think.
Okay, sorry, that's all we have. Can you give them one last round?